affected by the crisis. The 40 biggest French companies are doing very well despite the COVID crisis, but they prefer to pay benefits for their shareholders rather than improving working conditions. So the main concern for French trade unions now is to save jobs and to stop companies from firing workers.
The big companies have received a lot of public money without any social ecological conditions to fulfill. Public money cannot be given to companies that fire workers continue to pollute, companies that relocate. So we demand that strict conditions be imposed before giving public aid to companies.
The COVID crisis has highlighted the importance of ordinary workers for the French economy. Garbage collectors, railway workers, supermarket cashiers, mostly women, home care workers, delivery drivers, and, of course, hospital workers. Their work is now widely considered as essential to keep the economy running. French President Macron promised to re-evaluate their jobs.
Macron just promised a bonus that is not even obligatory. He does not want to increase the minimum wage, and that is for us the reference. The government thinks that the higher salaries will lead to less jobs, but for us it's the opposite. Higher salaries will boost the economy and create more jobs.
The demonstration in Paris was closely monitored by the police. Clashes broke out when more radical demonstrators threw stones and bottles to the police officers who charged and fired tear gas. There is a lot of frustration among working people. Many blame the French authorities for its disengagement from the public sector, especially the hospital sector, which is crucial to get the coronavirus under control.
The anger is still growing among working people. Those at the front line against the coronavirus demand a permanent upgrade of their jobs, salary and working conditions. But the French government, till now, has only paid them bonuses once. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Across the world, and even in the United States, people took to the streets to celebrate International Workers' Day, May 1st. The turbulent 2020 saw America reverse 50 years of political apathy. Marchers say the time for the lower and middle classes to unite is now, because the 1% is already united and profiting from soaring post-lockdown inequalities every day.
I do think that there will be a rise of leftism because, you know, when we're able to win certain gains through struggles like Black Lives Matter has, you know, getting Chauvin convicted, that shows the power of the working class to fight for more. And, this is just the beginning of the mobilizations I think we're going to see.
Given the status of Chicago as the ideological center of neoliberal thought, many may be surprised that the epicenter of the very first May Day ever was Chicago. In 1886, 100,000 Chicagoan leftists peacefully took to the streets to demand an 8-hour working day and were met with deadly police violence. The U.S. government failed to replace May Day with an attempt at Law and Order Day, but by 1890, the first International Workers' Day for Unity and Solidarity was declared. The holiday is celebrated in scores of countries and often called Labor Day, but most English-language countries celebrate their own Labor Day in autumn.
This is a day where we're connecting lots of struggles that are important to the workers' movement, right? Immigrants' rights, the defunding the police, the Black Lives Matter explosion of the last year, right? The uprising has shown that there is really a fighting mood within the U.S., the workers' movement in general.
Many 19th-century struggles are still being fought today, such as against the privileges and parasitism created by monarchies. New U.S. President Joe Biden just rejected a $15 per hour minimum wage, even though wages haven't been hiked since 2009, and non-governmental estimates of inflation are 10% annually. Businesses like Amazon are dubbed innovation heroes in the mainstream media, yet are notorious for grueling working conditions. Many marching on May Day also oppose Western liberal democracy, which is often accused of creating and protecting a new aristocracy on the backs of the average worker. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Another Joint Commission meeting among the remaining signatories of the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, comes to an end in Vienna. Iranian lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says an agreement has been reached to remove the majority of individuals and entities on the U.S. sanctions list and that negotiations are continuing on the rest of the names on the list. Araghchi had mentioned earlier that the U.S. has also agreed to lift sanctions on Iran's energy, finance, insurance, automotive and shipping sectors. But Iran is demanding the removal of all U.S. sanctions imposed after the U.S. withdrawal from the deal in 2018, including those imposed under other labels by the Trump administration.
It's a very complicated issue, and as you know, sanctions have different categories, and we have to deal with all of them. Of course, what is our guiding principle is the firm positions taken by the Islamic Republic of Iran and has been emphasized by the Supreme Leader.
Iran has also steadfastly opposed a step-by-step process, saying it would only go back to full compliance after all U.S. sanctions are lifted and the Islamic Republic verifies their effective removal. Araghchi said delegates are now involved in the time-consuming process of drafting an agreement.
Now we have some texts available to us based on the negotiations we have already made, and now we are working on the words and phrases and sentences and paragraphs.
EU coordinator Enrique Mora said there were moderate advances, adding that with more detail comes more complexity. While the U.S. delegation led by Robert Malley has been engaged in negotiations in Vienna, there's been no direct talks between Iran and the U.S. Delegates have decided to have further consultations in their respective capitals before returning for another joint commission session here at the end of next week. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets in the Gaza Strip after the Friday prayers in solidarity with Jerusalem al-Quds and its people. The Hamas movement organized a mass rally. The protesters slammed the acts of violence done by Israeli forces in Jerusalem al-Quds and expressed solidarity with Palestinians in the occupied territories.
Jerusalem al-Quds has always been our main cause of conflict and the destination of all the resistance and revolutions. We will not accept the Israeli regime's attempts to Judaize al-Quds by expelling and killing its people and demolishing their houses. Al-Quds is known for its brave men and women.
We are here to stress on our support to protesters in Jerusalem al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque and to tell them that we are here feeling what they feel and we will be all gathered to liberate Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds. I call on the international community to stand by our people in Al-Aqsa and support them against the inhumane Israeli regime.
The mass rally in Gaza, which occurred for a second Friday in a row, was triggered by Israeli restrictions on Palestinian worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque and the regime's crackdown on protesters against the restrictions. The protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed not to remain silent to the Israeli aggression against their brothers and sisters.
This is a message to our people in Jerusalem al-Quds that we will keep supporting and defending you against the Israeli occupation. We won't sit idle until seeing Al-Aqsa free and raising the flags of Palestine in Al-Quds. We are all united on the road of resistance against this occupation.
Palestinians consider resistance as the only way to respond to all Israeli violations and a key to liberating the occupied Palestinian territories.
In the middle of the holy month of Ramadan, the historic Jama Mosque in Srinagar, the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir, wears a deserted look. So are the other religious places across the region. Amid rapid surge in COVID cases, the religious bodies here have suspended congregational prayers and other religious gatherings.
We should understand the present situation. We request everyone to offer prayers at home instead of going to mosques. In this holy month, let's all pray for those affected by this virus and for an end to the pandemic.
Authorities in Kashmir have imposed lockdown to curb a surge in COVID infections and deaths. The announcement to impose lockdown came after the region recorded 700% increase in active COVID infections in this month alone. sending the alarm bells ringing. Officials have already banned gathering of more than four people, but essential services have been exempted from the lockdown. Authorities claim that there is no shortage of oxygen, medicines, and COVID vaccine in the region, saying the government is handling the COVID situation effectively. But some people blame authorities for their late response to the pandemic.
There was no robust system of testing at the airport, at the Srinagar airport. And the biggest problem in our case was that the government and the administration here threw open Tulip Garden and organized other Khelo programs, mass gatherings, fashion shows. So this was to showcase normalcy. And in the process, what happened that from 50 odd cases per day, now we are here where we have more than 3,000 cases on a daily basis. And there are 30 plus deaths.
India, the world's second most populous nation, remains in deep crisis as hospitals and morgues are overwhelmed by the pandemic, with medicine and oxygen in short supply and strict limits on movement imposed in the country's largest cities.
The second wave of COVID-19 pandemic is causing a steep rise in the number of infections and posing a huge challenge for health experts and the government here. Experts have warned that the fight against the pandemic is far from over and have urged the people not to drop their guard against the deadly virus. Say the least of Indian-administered Kashmir.
Palestinian refugees and Lebanese factions have held several gatherings in solidarity with Jerusalem al-Quds. Lebanese political representatives denounced the Israeli aggressive practices both in the occupied territories and the besieged Gaza Strip.
So we are here today to say to the world, and to especially to the Arab people, not the Arab leaders, that they should unite and stand against what's happening. They should be united against the crimes against humanity we are seeing. Innocent people are being bombarded every day. Innocent kids and people are being killed every day, and nobody's lifting a finger.
Palestinian factions stress that as long as Palestinians are able to protect their historic right to their homeland, then there is no fear that Israel or any collaborators can steal it away.
The battle for Al-Quds is a battle on behalf of the entire nation, so the least we can do is to give support to this intifada. This is an extension of several uprisings since 2015 and until today. The occupation forces want to grasp control over the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its surroundings. Palestinian protesters need support, and today we tell them that the Al-Quds is not alone. We saw the support from the West Bank and Gaza to Al-Quds, which shows that Jerusalem Al-Quds won't be left alone.
The speech is noted that all the resistance factions, whether in Lebanon or Palestine, and the entire resistance bloc, united stands with the Palestinian people in their fight for freedom and life.
Your steadfastness is a humiliation to the occupation. We stand with you every single day, and soon we will liberate Palestine.
I tell our brothers in Al-Quds that God is with you, and this means no one can defeat you. I tell all the people of Palestine, hold on, victory is near. You're the rightful owners of this land.
Protests and confrontations broke out in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds after Israeli authorities decided to break a pledge of respecting the right to worship by forcing their way into Al-Aqsa Mosque's four minarets in order to silence the evening call to prayers. The Israeli violence has evoked anger across the Arab and Muslim worlds.
A salute to Jerusalem Al-Quds and the steadfastness of the Palestinian people in the Holy Land is what Lebanese and Palestinian activists have gathered for today. And despite all blockades and Israeli aggressive policies, they stress that the younger generations will resist more than ever before. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
After a still deeply disputed election, new United States President Joe Biden has reached 100 days in office with a lower approval rating than any other newly elected president since 1953, excepting Donald Trump. Many believe the country is only in a temporary political calm, which could be broken with the reported return of Trump to the political rally circuit in May.
Well, I don't know if the honeymoon is over. I think in some cases the honeymoon was over a few days after the inauguration, or even before the inauguration.
Biden finally gave his address, where he also unveiled a 10-year social infrastructure plan which is expected to get many months of pushback from Congress. Many say Biden has had some successes. The coronavirus vaccine distribution, the $2 trillion infrastructure plan, ending the Muslim travel ban, and returning to the Paris Climate Agreement. But Biden has already backtracked from campaign promises in many vital areas. The fight for $15 per hour, the amount and length of unemployment payments, total household stimulus payments, dropping Medicare eligibility to 60 years old, student debt relief, reversing Trump's tax cuts for the rich, and more.
He's reneged on everything he promised, and he comes up with an excuse. I can't do it, or we can't do it because one guy's voting against it. We can't do it because the parliamentarian has decided we can't put it in the bill. I mean, people are pretty much aware that these are lame excuses, and that the Democrats, and Biden especially, are just using these lame excuses to not do what they said they would do.
At 100 days and amid similar economic disaster, Franklin Delano Roosevelt had passed 15 major bills which established hugely influential initiatives. Contrarily, Biden's $1.9 trillion economic stimulus package didn't establish a single long-term program. On foreign policy, Biden has adopted almost all of the stances of his controversial predecessor. He has not lifted sanctions on Iran nor returned to the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program. Russia's foreign minister said Biden's refusal of diplomacy and lack of respect could make relations worse than even during the Cold War. He has not taken Cuba off the state terrorist list, and he adopted Trump's widely criticized low quota for asylum seekers despite a crisis on the southern border. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Commissioners have found that both U.S. laws and police practices, as documented in the 44 cases heard by the commissioners and national data, do not comply with the international standards on the use of force, says Marjorie Kahnreiter in an article titled, Commission Finds Anti-Black Police Violence in U.S. Constitutes Crimes Against Humanity. Stay tuned for the details, please. On April 27th, the International Commission of Inquiry on Systematic Racist Police Violence Against People of African Descent in the United States of America issued its long-awaited report on the U.S.'s police-perpetrated racist violence. The commissioners concluded that the systematic police killings of black people in the U.S. constitutes a prima facie case of crimes against humanity, and they asked the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, ICC, to initiate an investigation of responsible police officials. These crimes against humanity under the ICC's Rome Statute include murder, severe deprivation of physical liberty, torture, persecution of people of African descent, and inhuman acts causing great suffering or serious injury to body or mental or physical health. All of the crimes occurred in the context of a widespread or systematic attack directed against the civilian population of black people in the United States, as documented by the findings of fact in a 188-page report. The 12 commissioners are eminent experts and jurists from Asia, Africa, Latin America, Europe, and the Caribbean. After 18 days of hearings and extensive research, the commissioner found that both U.S. law and police practices do not comply with international law. testimony of family members, attorneys, activists, and experts about police killings of 43 black people and the paralyzing of another was presented to the commissioners. All of the victims were unarmed or were not threatening the officers or others. Philanois Floyd, brother of George Floyd, testified before the commissioners. At a press conference announcing the release of the report, he said, "I want to thank the commissioner for recognizing my humanity as a good black man in America and for recognizing my brother George's humanity and the humanity of other families across this nation and bringing to light and acknowledging the United States government is perpetrating crimes against humanity against black people in the United States. This finding of crimes against humanity was not given lightly. We included it with a very clear mind," Commissioner Hina Jilani from Pakistan told The Guardian. "We examined all the facts and concluded that there are situations in the U.S. that beg the urgent scrutiny of the ICC." The commissioners made the following findings of fact. Pretextual traffic stops are a common precursor to police killings and uses of excessive force against people of African descent. Tavis Crane was killed by police after his young daughter threw a piece of candy out of the window. Race-based street stops, known as a stop and frisk, often trigger the use of deadly force by police. Eric Garner was suspected of selling individual untaxed cigarettes. George Floyd was suspected of using a counterfeit $20 bill. Fourth Amendment violations invariably lead to the use of excessive force and police killings of black people. Breonna Taylor was killed following the execution of a no-knock warrant after a judge had replaced it with a knock warrant. Police routinely use excessive and lethal restraints against black people. They include tasers, chokeholds, compression, asphyxia, rough rights, and the use of vehicles as deadly weapons. George Floyd died from asphyxia. Freddie Gray was taken on a 45-minute rough right resulting in his death. Lethal police violence against black people is exacerbated by officers' failure to provide medical attention. For example, Andrew Kearse was kept in the back of a squad car for 17 minutes as he begged for help, repeating, "I can't breathe." He died of a heart attack in the car. Lethal police violence against black people experiencing a mental health crisis is systematic. After Daniel Pruitt's family called police to provide mental health assistance, he was walking naked in the street. The officers put a spit hood over his head after he began spitting. They held him face down on the pavement for 2 minutes and 15 seconds, and he stopped breathing. Systematic racist police violence kills and traumatizes black children and youth. 12-year-old Tammy Rice was shot to death by police as he played in a park with a toy gun. The young children of Jacob Blake witnessed their father being shot and paralyzed by police. And racist police violence traumatizes and devastates families and communities across the U.S. Manuel Elijah Ellis was hit, punched, choked, and tasered to death by American police. Black immigrants are particularly vulnerable to systematic racist police violence and police killings. Bahram Jin, born in St. Lucia, was eating ice cream in his apartment when an officer walked in, mistakenly thinking it was hers, and shot him dead. "What was she defending?" Allison Jin, Bahram Jin's mother, asked, as the only weapon he held was the color of his skin. Legal actors are complicit in police violence and killings of black people through qualified immunity and systematic impunity of officers. Police officers in the United States enjoy impunity for their racist violence. They are rarely held accountable for killing black people, and qualified Immunity protects them against liability for violation of constitutional rights. Alarming pattern of destruction and manipulation of evidence, cover-ups, and obstruction of justice. Prosecutors have a conflict of interest, and medical examiners often do the bidding of police. After Darren Wilson killed Michael Brown, as Brown raised his hands and said, "Don't shoot," the officer backed his own gun and washed Brown's blood off his hands. After police killed Henry Glover, the officers burned the car with his body in it. Prosecutional misconduct and grand jury abuse. The offending officers testified at the grand juries in the killings of both Michael Brown and Tammy Rice, and in neither case was the officer cross-examined. There were no incitements of officers in either case. Systematic impunity and lack of oversight by police. Internal affairs investigations invariably exonerate officers. Police can't be trusted to police themselves. The blue wall of silence keeps officers from reporting misconduct by fellow officers. Police unions facilitate impunity of officers. The police union got the body camera footage a few days after the killing of Daniel Prud, but it took the Prud family 6 months to get it, and only after they filed several lawsuits and qualified immunity. A recent U.S. District Court judge wrote, "Judges have invented a legal doctrine to protect law enforcement officers from having to face any consequences for wrongdoing." The doctrine is called qualified immunity. In real life, it operates like absolute immunity. In case after case heard by the commissioners, victims' families face extraordinary obstacles to holding officers accountable for the killing of their family members. The commissioners found that systematic racist police violence against people of African descent in the United States of America has resulted in a pattern of gross and reliably attested violations of human rights and fundamental freedoms. These include violations of the right to life, the right to liberty and security, the right to mental health, the right to be free from arbitrary detention, and the right to be free from torture and other cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatments, including by the use of tasers, chokeholds, and compression asphyxia. The U.S. torture statute only punishes torture committed abroad. The commissioners also found violations of the right to be free from discrimination based on race, gender, disability, or status as a child. The stop and frisk doctrine is an invitation for racial profiling, and the Supreme Court allows pretextual stops for traffic violations even when the officer is motivated by racism in violation of international law. In addition, the commissioners found violations of the right to a fair trial and the presumption of innocence, which constitute extrajudicial killings, as well as the right to be treated with humanity and respect. The commissioners found violations of the duty to provide medical care to detailed persons, to ensure investigations of extrajudicial killings that are independent, competent, thorough, and effective, and to prosecute suspects and punish perpetrators to ensure they are held accountable. The commissioners found that both U.S. laws and police practices, as documented in the 44 cases heard by the commissioners and national data, do not comply with the international standards on the use of force.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
the debate.
For dozens of Palestinians living in the occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, the threat of eviction from their homes looms over their heads. This after a court ruled that at least six families must vacate their homes in the area by Thursday, despite having lived there for generations. A separate ruling by the same court means seven other families face the eviction by August the 1st. This edition of the debate is about Israel's land grab policy and settlement activities, which are illegal under international law. We're now joined by our correspondent, Mona Candy, who's with us from Ramallah, to tell us more about the recent eviction notices. Mona?
Well, the Israeli court on Sunday postponed a decision to evict Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, till next Thursday. According to the latest ruling by the Israeli court, it says the families must reach an agreement with the settler groups who want to take over their property by Thursday. Seven other families have to leave their homes by August the 1st. We are speaking about more than 500 Palestinians from some 28 families living in Sheikh Jarrah. They were forced out from their homes in the cities of Haifa and Yaffa in 1948, and they settled in Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, under the UNRWA program when East Jerusalem was under the Jordanian rule. Now we are speaking about attempts by the Israeli settlers to take over their homes. In 1972, Israeli settler groups filed lawsuit against the families in Sheikh Jarrah, claiming that they are the real owners of the land. However, they don't have any anything to prove their ownership of the land or the homes. That's why the Palestinians are insisting that they have to stay in Sheikh Jarrah. Clashes had been taking place between the settlers and the Palestinians living in Sheikh Jarrah for years, and in the recent weeks, on a daily basis, the Palestinians were clashing with the Israeli settlers in order to defend their homes and their land in Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds.
All right, thanks a lot, Mona. That was Mona Candil joining us from Ramallah. Joining us also on tonight's debate, we have award-winning Palestinian journalist Daoud Kutab, joining us from Amman. Also, a journalist and commentator, Brecht Yonkers, joining us from Hasselt. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Kutab in Amman. More land grab and evictions by the Israeli regime. As we know, under international law, the Israeli judicial system has no legal authority over the population that it occupies. Human Rights Watch said Israel's policies amount to apartheid and crimes against humanity. The question is, why are these policies still continuing?
Well, the Israeli government is a right-wing fascist government that is trying to make Jerusalem a Jewish city and to change its identity and status as an Arab, Palestinian, Christian, and Muslim city. And so we saw yesterday the lighting of the fire ceremonies, Palestinian Christians were attacked. We saw that the Palestinian elections had to be postponed because Israel refuses to honor its own agreement on Jerusalem, Jerusalem is participating, and Sheikh Jarrah is the most visible, visible site where the Israelis are trying to physically remove hundreds of Palestinians from homes they've lived in for decades and replace them with the Israeli Jews who have nothing to do with these lands, who are not the real owners of the land, but because this land was rented by the Jordanians to UNRWA, the UN agency. They're saying that that rental agreement is null and void, even though it is very much the law of the land that tenants are protected. And now that the Israeli courts see that they don't have a chance, they're trying to push the two sides to negotiate a settlement which would really, in the long term, help the settlers.
Mr. Yonkers, I'd like to get your thoughts on that as well. what are the Israelis achieving with its land grab policy, apart from a Judaization of Palestinian land, which Mr. Qutob just alluded to? Are the Israelis, in your opinion, also deliberately trying to sabotage any prospects of peace with these actions?
Yes, of course. This has been Zionist policy ever since 1948, attacking, and then when you're being counterattacked, claim that you are the victim, and then play the international community and international public opinion in order to portray the Jewish Zionist settlers as some sort of eternal victim, with, of course, the comparisons or the allusions to the Holocaust in Nazi Germany never very far away. This is a continuous theater that the Zionists have been playing for over 70 years now, and of course has only increased after their occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem in 1967. So when I think the Judaization of all of Palestine is basically simply set the main major goal right now, let's say, like this, somewhat of a short-term goal or a middle-term goal of the Zionist entity, the longer-term goal probably being further territorial expansion beyond the borders of the Zionist entity and the state of Palestine itself. So things like this are a very commonplace occurrence, as I'm sure Palestinians in Palestine and outside as well will attest to. The goal of the Zionist entity has always been, and several Zionist politicians have always been very open about this, the goal has always been the complete and total takeover of what they see as the area of Eretz Israel, and to the removal of the people who live there, either the removal or the assimilation or the murder of people living there, and their replacement or subjugation by a what they claim to be a, let's say, pure race, quote-unquote pure race Jewish nation, Jewish people, which by itself is an anachronism. There is no such thing as a pure race Jewish people or a Jewish race in general. It doesn't exist, but in the mindset of the Zionist political ideology, the idea has always been to remove each and every person living there. You can say that they have been taking their time in doing it because it's been over 70 years, and of course there are still many Palestinians living there, but it's not for lack of trying. You know, they have been trying to encroach more and more on Palestinian lands ever since the establishment of the Zionist entity, and even before that, and basically ever since the Balfour Declaration in 1917. And for them, it is really a thorn in their side that there are still Arab people, both Muslim and Christian, living in what they consider to be Greater Israel. And of course, the city of Al-Quds of Jerusalem is probably the most important short-term goal for the Zionist entity, even before they want to move on to the rest of the West Bank and, of course, the Gaza Strip, because they consider Al-Quds to be their quote-unquote indivisible Jewish capital of their Jewish state, as has been supported, of course, by Donald Trump and the neoconservatives in the White House a few years ago, officially as well. So the existence of Arab Palestinians living in East Jerusalem for the Zionists is probably, let's say, the immediate goal right now. First, they want to remove the people. Eventually, they will want to move on to the destruction of the noble sanctuary of the Al-Aqsa Masjid, in order to make place, of course, for what they consider to be the resurrection of the Temple of Solomon, that they believe should be reconstructed in this location. So this is, I believe, their first step towards their expansion.
Mr. Qutob, the past 4 years, the Trump administration was just nonstop U.S. support for Israel through various policies. Joe Biden, when he was taking office, he indicated that his administration will restore Washington's pre-Trump policy of opposing settlement expansion, but he nonetheless claimed ironclad support for Israel. Now, many analysts say the difference between Trump and the new administration is no more than some tactics, and both have the same established foreign policy towards Israel and the Arabs. Do you agree with that?
Well, you know, Biden's election campaign did say that they want to reopen the PLO office in Washington, but they're running into congressional problems because they declared the PLO to be a terrorist organization. And by the U.S. law, terrorist organization not allowed to have an office in Washington. Now, in the past, they had a waiver where every 6 months the president would sign a waiver that this is for national security reasons. But that even doesn't work. So we have a trouble in getting some of the basic promises made by Biden when he was running for government. I do think there is a difference between Biden and Trump. Trump had his deal of the century plan that would have annexed one-third of the Palestinian West Bank. I think that has been defeated, and I don't think that Biden would resurrect it. Biden does want to keep the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, although there's a big question mark if that's ever going to become a real embassy or just a sign on a building. But we will see about that. There is still too early to judge whether the Biden administration would abide by the last decision that was made by the Obama-Biden administration in the Security Council number 2334, which stated that all settlements are illegal, including settlements in East Jerusalem. So that was a very strong statement where they abstained from, but it became part of the UN security resolutions. And if Biden is serious about human rights, then he must read very carefully the 230-page report by the Human Rights Watch, which said that between the river and the sea, Israel is committing crimes of apartheid. And certainly what we're seeing in East Jerusalem and Jerusalem in general is apartheid, because they're taking over Palestinian land, homes, but there are plenty of Palestinian homes in West Jerusalem that are now occupied by Jewish people, and they're not returning those to their original owners. So you can't have it both ways. You cannot keep what you took over in 1948 and say, you know, this is absentee property, and then you come to the Arab side and say, well, these homes used to at one time belong to Jews 50 years ago, and therefore people have to leave them. So it's a double, it's a duplicate strategy, which is a crime of apartheid.
Brett Yonker's Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, he said Joe Biden thinks the best way to ensure Israel's future and to give the Palestinians a state which they are entitled is through the so-called two-state solution. Now, if that is the policy, then there has to be a change on the issue of settlements, because there's a clear inconsistency regarding the issue of a viable Palestinian state and the expansion of settlements, isn't there?
Well, yes, definitely. And I think that it's an issue that has to be addressed every time when Joe Biden or Antony Blinken speak about the return to pre-Trump time. We have to bear in mind, of course, we have to ask ourselves the question, what was the status quo before Trump? The status quo before Trump might not have been, you know, as blatantly, blatantly insulting as Donald Trump was when he moved the embassy to Jerusalem, for example, but it was still a situation that was deeply unjust, deeply unfair, and in violation of all, let's say, humanitarian laws and laws of decency, because we were talking about a time that for decades already, while the United States claimed that they did not support, let's say, the Zionist colonies in the West Bank, they de facto have never done anything to stop it. In fact, they have been trying to obstruct international justice every single step of the way. So a simple, let's say, return to a time pre-Trump is definitely not something that is, let's say, that is justified or that is a solution for what's going on now. The issue at hand, of course, is that these colonies exist, these settlements in the West Bank, in Eastern Al-Quds, they exist. And as long as they continue to exist, whether or not you officially recognize them will have very little effect immediately on the Palestinians who are suffering under them. There are Palestinians being harassed, being murdered, even in the West Bank on a nearly, let's say, weekly, daily basis by these illegal settlers. And yes, you can say we don't recognize them. Even Israel can say that they don't technically yet annex them into Israel proper. They're not really, let's say, quote-unquote, part of the State of Israel, if we call it that. But in reality, of course, they are there. They do exist. They exist in the same way as the U.S. war on Yemen exists, despite the fact that this war was never declared. Maybe there is no official annexation of the West Bank or of Al-Quds yet, or Al-Quds nowadays there is. But the fact that these colonizations continue unabated and unhindered will completely destroy any prospects of potential peace and negotiation. So the first thing that needs to happen before any other negotiation can happen, in my opinion, is that every single settlement in the West Bank and in Eastern Al-Quds has to be dismantled and has to be every single settler has to be removed. And only then you can say we can talk. And even then we're talking, of course, about an unfair situation of borders that were built by Zionist settlers after 1948, but at least then we can have a certain first step forward. As long as there are settlers in internationally recognized Palestinian lands, basically any possible negotiation, any possible negotiated two-state solution is already dead in the water before it even starts.
Right, Mr. Khattab, Mahmoud Abbas said those who believe the Palestinians can coexist with the occupation or will be subdued by pressure are under an illusion. Are restarting talks on the basis of a two-state solution even an option anymore, given the recent developments?
I don't know that we'll be starting talks anytime soon. Israel doesn't have a government yet, and the Biden administration has not really settled into what their policy and position is. So I don't think we're having negotiations anytime soon. You know, the negotiations that existed when John Kerry was the prior Secretary of State, basically stopped when the Israelis built new settlements and stopped releasing the prisoners who were imprisoned before the Oslo Accords. So I think you cannot start talks before you fix some of the problems that caused the last time there was talks to evaporate. So, you know, Israel has to have a government, the U.S. has to clarify its position, and then you have to reverse the actions that were done and fulfill the promises that were made before the April 2014 elections blew up and what John Kerry said, they went in poof because the settlements, Israel, you know, built new settlements in violation of the 10-month moratorium that they had agreed to.
Brett Yonkers, for years, with the help of the Western-administered media, the Israelis were trying to control the narrative to portray the Palestinians as terrorists and having the Israeli security being at risk. You also alluded to that earlier. Arguably, that narrative, many would say, doesn't even exist anymore. There's a clear sense of global awareness now towards the Palestinian cause. For example, we have the Al-Quds Day rally soon in Iran, which brings more attention to the Palestinian cause. Tell us more, please.
Yeah, I think there is a clear growing, let's say, popular anger against the continued existence of Zionism and the Zionist entity in Palestine, all across the Arab world, all across the Islamic world, and all across the entire globe, basically, as well. We see a massive solidarity campaigns with Palestine in Latin America, in Africa, even in Europe and in North America as well nowadays. So, but the problem, of course, being that they still try to maintain the narrative, especially, of course, in a time of under the Donald Trump administration, the Israelis tried to control the narrative in a different way, being in the name of what they call the Abraham Accords, in the name of what they see as a form of international diplomacy. And nowadays, they try to hijack the name of a religious rapprochement, religious cooperation between Abrahamic religions. You see that played very well, for example, in certain sources in the United Arab Emirates when they signed this treacherous treaty with the Zionist entity in which they claim that this is done from an idea of Jewish Islamic unity because we are all, you know, they're all Abrahamic religions, which, of course, is a complete subversion of what it means to be religious, what it means to be Jewish versus what it means to be Zionist, and it completes... let's say what they try to do is they try to heap together being anti-Zionist and anti-Semitic. And they try to claim that if you are a Muslim who does not support Zionism, you must be, you know, an anti-Semite, you must be a terrorist, you know, and you must be Al-Qaeda or whatever. If you're a Christian and you don't support Zionism, you often get conflated with Nazi Germany. So this is an issue that keeps on going. But fortunately, despite the corruption of certain regimes in the Arab world and in the Islamic world in general, you see that even in those countries, there are millions and millions of people who oppose the actions of their own government. There are, I believe, Gallup polls that have been taken just a few years ago in Egypt, one of the first countries in the Arab world to collaborate with Israel, in which it turns out that over 90% of the population said that they oppose the recognition of the Zionist entity. This is in a country that's been recognizing and collaborating with the Zionists since the 1970s. So this is a massive cause for hope. If an actual, let's say, popular uprising or popular change were to take place in countries like this, in which the popular will is expressed by their governments, you can possibly see a very quick change in the way things are being done. And the best example for that is, as you mentioned, of course, the Al-Quds rallies are being held in Iran. Many people forget that Iran used to recognize and collaborate the Zionist entity prior to the Islamic Revolution. In fact, the Shah of Iran was a very close ally of Israel. And after 1979, when the Islamic Revolution was victorious, they completely made a 180-degree in this situation and are now one of the staunchest, Iran is now one of the staunchest supporters of Palestine in the world. Similar things have been shown even in Latin America among some of the revolutionary governments there. So there is always this hope in which you can that people fight back against the Zionist fascist
right.
narrative, against this Holocaust industry that they have been trying to build up in order to portray themselves as the victims. And I think that is still one major cause for hope in the world right now.
And one last question for Mr. Kutav Inamon, very briefly, if you may, sir. What alternatives do Palestinians have now? Many observers say that resistance is the only viable option for the Palestinians.
Absolutely, the resistance is important, but you can't have strong and effective resistance without two conditions. You need to have unity of the Palestinians and the support of Arab, Islamic, and international forces. You cannot have resistance by Palestinians by themselves, because the Israelis would crush us. We need the protection of our friends and allies around the world, and we need to be united in our direction. We need to use nonviolent means so that they don't turn back against us. And I think the unity plus international support could bring results.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Allow me to thank my guest for this debate, award-winning Palestinian journalist Daoud Kutav.